This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Trigg McClellan. I'm a professor of orthopedics at UCSF, co-director of the Spine Center, and clinical director of the biomechanical testing facility. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. If you were wondering, it is a red state. If you don't know where Tennessee is, it's about right there, and it's red. I went to Vanderbilt, graduated in 1981 from medical school. I did my general surgery there, followed by my orthopedic residency at the University of Michigan. I did my trauma fellowship at San Francisco General. Then I did a spine fellowship in L.A. at the Curlin Job Clinic. I've done a few things in my life, but the only thing I've done perfect is I've never missed a day of school or work in my entire life. There's my perfect attendance diploma in 1961 that I have proud. That's the only thing I have framed in my office. Murat Pekmetsi is one of my partners, and he's from Ankara, Turkey. I've got a map up there. And Murat is an associate professor of clinical orthopedic surgery at UCSF and probably the most well-trained orthopedic doctor in our entire group. He graduated from medical school from Hacettepe University in Turkey, spent some time in Colombia. He did his residency in the Department of Orthopedics at Hacettepe. He did three, not one, not two, but three fellowships. Most orthopedic surgeons do one, maybe two, but he did three fellowships at UCSF, two of them, and one at Wash U in St. Louis. So he knows a lot about everything. He also received the 2011 Best Teacher Award in the Department of Orthopedics. Jeremy LaRouche is from Val d'Or, however you pronounce it. It's in Lovey Court. And if you can't find it because you're driving around, just look for the big snow machine shooting snow.
That's July, by the way.
Yeah. Jeremy is a highly trained orthopedic surgeon. He's an assistant professor of orthopedics, and he went to Northern Ontario School of Medicine, did his residency at the University of Toronto, did an orthopedic trauma fellowship at the University of British Columbia. He did a spine fellowship at the University of Toronto, and Jeremy was in the Royal Canadian Navy and received some sort of a decoration award. And I just would like to thank our Canadian partners for their naval support in Afghanistan. And he was a naval navigator, and I think he was pretty successful at that. So we're going to cover a lot of topics today. These are just some of them, and we'll try to go through it so that, you know, you can understand from a layman's terms what we're really talking about. Just some brief anatomy. This is the neck, the cervical spine. There are seven cervical vertebrae. The upper two are different shapes than the lower five, but the axis and the atlas are the upper two, and there's most of the rotation, 50% of your rotation occurs through the upper cervical spine. The vertebral bodies are separated by a disc, which consists of an outer annulus, a fibrous annulus, which is a very thick structure with a center made of a nucleus, which is mostly water, but it's a jelly-like substance on the inside. In the back, this is the backside, these little facet joints are shingles, like shingled joints. And then from the side, you see the vertebral bodies separated by a disc, and then the nerve roots that go down into your arm come out of these foramen or holes in the between the facet joints and the vertebral bodies. So if you look at a cross-section of the spine, this is the roof, the lamina, here's the spinal cord, and the exiting nerve root comes out through the foramen. The disc, the floor of the spinal canal, is either the disc or the vertebral body itself. But the disc, again, is made up of an outer annulus, and then the center is the nucleus pulposus, which is made up mostly of water. This is a side view of the lower spine, the lumbar spine. Again, the vertebral bodies are numbered L2, L3, L4, L5, and S1, which is the sacrum. And then there's a disc that's between each lumbar vertebrae. The spinal cord actually stops at T12, L1, and below that level, just nerves are floating in a sac, the dural sac, in fluid. And you can see this is a cross-section at the L5 level, so there's no spinal cord down in your lower back. It's just nerves floating in a sac of fluid, as depicted there. This is another depiction of the lumbar spine. And really, just what I want to show you here is there's some important ligaments, the anterior longitudinal ligament, posterior longitudinal ligament. Those are ligaments that hold the vertebral bodies together. There's ligamentum flavum, which is a yellow ligament that connects the lamina. And then there's other ligaments around the spine. These are very, very dense, strong ligaments, and we'll talk about some of that when we talk about the biomechanics. So before we get into other stuff, we have to have a clear definition of what is an injury. And I know it sounds sort of trivial, but there are some challenges and complexities when we say what is an injury to the spine. Unlike other diseases, you have to have a causative event and you have to have a resulting pathology. So a simple orthopedic definition of injury is a mechanical disruption of a biological tissue that causes pain. I mean, that's pretty simple. Unfortunately, the notion that an injury must have a sudden, discernible effect leading to tissue damage excludes a lot of possible injuries like chronic low-energy exposures, cumulative trauma disorders, like carpal tunnel or a disc herniation. So I'll show you that disc herniations usually are not a result of a single traumatic event. So this is really complicated, but there are a lot of theories that look at regarding injury causation. One of the theories, multivariate interaction theory, talks about common denominators of genetic endowment, morphological characteristics, psychosocial makeup, and occupational biomechanical hazards. So, I mean, this is very complicated, and it has a lot of relevance in the occupational medicine world. The other theory, cumulative load theory, that's a low-energy repetitive trauma can cause injury, and I'll give you some examples of that, because we, as you know, all material substances have a finite failure. They'll fail with cyclical loading. So here's some, since we're part of the Orthopedic Trauma Institute, we need to talk about injury. The leading cause of death in the U.S. is trauma, is injury, up to age 44. One person dies from an injury every 3 minutes. More than 2.5 million people are hospitalized for injury every year. More than 31.6 million people are treated in the emergency department. And there's an annual spend of almost $500 million related to medical costs and lost productivity. As far as spinal cord injury goes, the statistics from 2010 to 2015, vehicular accidents and falls are the most common cause of paraplegia and quadriplegia. Violent sports injuries, medical surgical complications are also in that category, but most of it, over half, is vehicular or a fall from a height. As of 2015, 12,500 new spinal cord injuries occur each year, and there's probably around 250,000 to 300,000 people in the U.S. that are living with a spinal cord injury today. So this doesn't seem like it's relevant to this talk, but I want you to understand the difference between impairment and disability. Impairment is a medical term, and it means loss of physiologic or psychologic function and due to an injury or one of these other conditions. You can put an objective number to impairment. There's the AMA guidelines that will allow us to put a percent of body loss based on an injury. Whereas disability is a legal determination, and it means loss or limitation of opportunities to take part in society on an equal level due to social or environmental barriers. So in other words, a judge makes the determination of disability. A doctor determines impairment. The best example I can think of is if I broke the tip of my finger and I was a concert pianist, I'd be 100% disabled. If I was a football player, it'd be zero disability. Same impairment, but 100% disability versus zero. So lower back pain, the reason I mention that is lower back pain is the top cause for years of lost productivity due to disability. I mean, there was a meta-analysis that was published in 2010 looking at 117 studies from 47 different countries, and lower back pain is the number one cause for years lost due to disability. So Social Security receives more disability applications for back problems than anything else, and you know, if you file a claim, you're going to have to call your lawyer, disability lawyer. It's going to have to go before a judge, and there has to be a specific diagnosis such as a fracture. Otherwise, you probably won't get disability. I only put this in there because this is something that most orthopedic surgeons don't like, and that's occupational injury. And we see a lot of neck and back, quote, injuries at work. If you have pain at work, is there an injury or is there not? I don't know. It has to be evaluated and put through the system, but there's a lot of paperwork involved. So what about biomechanics? So anytime there's an injury, we have to evaluate the mechanism. And biomechanics is really the study of laws relating to movement or structure of a living organism. There are different ways we can do it. You can do mathematical modeling with finite element analysis. You can do cadaver studies, human volunteers, or crash dummies. So if you look at the spine, the thoracic spine from T1 to T8 really is a very stiff, rigid structure, and it usually just fails in flexion. The mobile lumbar spine, where it connects to the rigid thoracic spine, there's a transition zone at that junction between T9 and L2 where you transition from stiff to mobile, and most injuries actually occur at that zone because of that transition. Whereas in the lumbar spine, where there's more mobility and a lordosis here, most injuries are due to an axial load. So we can do biomechanical testing of cadaver specimens. We put them in these fancy testing machines and devices to measure load and displacement. There's actually a study where they took a human volunteer, a 45-year-old man, weighed 70 kilograms. They put a pressure transducer in his back and measured him for 24 hours, you know, all the activities of daily living. And what they found that when he lifted a 20-kilogram weight with bending forward with his knees straight, there was a 4.5-fold increase in intradiscal pressure. They also found, interestingly, that the pressure increased in the disc 240% after he'd been in bed for 7 hours lying flat. So why is that? Well, presumably there's rehydration of the disc, but I found that pretty interesting that after you go to bed, lying there for 6-7 hours, the pressure in your disc actually increases. So biomechanical studies can be done with crash dummies. You know, there's a lot of information you can get from analyzing victims of car accidents and these high-speed deceleration injuries. And here are just some amazing numbers. A vertebral body compression fracture, 20, 30 Gs. Fracture dislocation, 20 to 40. Aortic transection, 80 to 100. Pelvic fractures, 100 to 200 Gs. Body fragmentation, so your body will fragment at 350 Gs. Now, this is where I actually looked this up. I was a physics major. The human body is more resistant to disruption than an aircraft. So when they test aircraft wings, they flex them and cycle them to failure. Your body is more resistant to failure than an aircraft wing. So good luck on your next flight. let's talk about low back pain in athletes. You know, this is an area of a lot of research. 90% of all tour golfers, all professional golfers, 90% of them, of the injuries are related to the neck or the back. You guys are all familiar with Tiger Woods' predicament. The golfers have the analysis of the golf swing. You know, there are a lot of research. There's a lot of research involving the golf swing analysis. In one study in particular, they calculated the compressive shear and lateral bending loads at L3, L4 in the lumbar spine swinging a 5-iron. And what they found was that the compressive load is higher among professionals and amateurs, but it was 7,500 to 6,100 newtons, which is 8 times your body weight. So every time you swing a 5-iron, the compressive load through the lumbar spine, through that L3, 4 disc, is 8 times your body weight. So when you take a guy that's practicing swinging 1,000 times, that is an incredible load on the disc. So the swing is, there's sufficient force in the golf swing to potentially injure the lumbar spine. And remember, one of the theories that we talked about for injury was cumulative load theory. So it's usually not a one-time swing catastrophic failure. It's a cumulative load and cyclical load over time. So there's a reason that men don't live as long as women. And if you look at a guy like this, you know, if he falls, you know, he's going to get a fracture. He's going to get a burst fracture where the vertebral body basically explodes and splinters into the spinal canal. But, you know, unfortunately, women have issues too, and there's a much higher incidence of osteoporosis in women, and these types of vertebral compression fractures can result from almost no trauma. You can just simply bend forward, sneeze, lift something, walking up and down the steps, you can get a vertebral compression fracture from osteoporosis. There are about 700,000 of those a year. A lot of them go undiagnosed. There's a lot of hospitalizations related to VCFs or vertebral compression fractures. There's some risk factors, age, low bone mineral density, osteoporosis, steroid use, smoking, some other risk factors associated with VCFs. If you look at a study that was done in 2005, 334 people 65 or older, if they had three or more vertebral compression fractures, their quality of life was comparable to somebody with a stroke or cancer. So it's a significantly disabling condition to have multiple vertebral compression fractures. If you have one, if women have one, there's a 20% chance they'll get another one within the same year. If you look at, so we want to move to one other topic here, and that's disc herniation or a pinched nerve in the neck. There was a nice population study from the Mayo Clinic over a 15-year period. They looked at 561 patients that had cervical radiculopathy, which basically means a pinched nerve in the neck, arm pain, numbness in your arm, or weakness in your arm. Only 14.8% had a history of trauma. So most of those conditions were not caused by a traumatic event. The patient just noticed that they had pain in the arm or numbness or tingling or weakness and went to the doctor. So again, not caused by trauma. This is just age, wear and tear, and cumulative multiple, you know, cyclical loading events to the disc. So how do we make the diagnosis of spinal injury? There are three things that we do. We do a history, we do an exam, imaging studies, and the imaging studies are x-rays, CAT scans, and MRIs. So this is a picture of, you know, we know the wiring diagram of your spinal cord and your nerve roots. So that's why we ask you specifically where is the distribution of pain, because we want to know which nerve is affected. In a patient with a spinal cord injury, we do a detailed neurologic exam, sensory and motor, as well as reflexes, and that also includes a rectal exam because the sacral nerve roots innervate the rectum. So you want to do a complete examination of somebody that has a spinal cord injury. This is a typical x-ray of a normal person. Again, the vertebral bodies are numbered. With an x-ray, you're looking mostly at bone. The shadows are the soft tissues, but you can see the spacing where the disc should be. You don't really see the disc, but it's normal because the spacing looks normal. And so we get some information here. If we want more detailed information, we get a CAT scan, which shows bony detail and much greater detail of the bony anatomy, and to detect subtle fractures that you might not see on an x-ray. An MRI scan shows mainly the disc, the soft tissues, and the spinal cord. So this is the spinal cord, that black thing. The white is the fluid around the nerves. The disc, remember, is mostly water. That shows up in this image as a white structure here. These are normal-looking discs. So does an MRI always confirm a specific injury? So when we're evaluating a patient with an injury and they fall 30 feet and they break their back, it's very obvious. If you have a patient that comes in that has neck or back pain and arm or leg pain, and we do a nice history and physical, but and we get an MRI, does that always confirm an injury? Well, the answer is probably not. And this was a study that was done by some Swiss radiologists. They looked at cervical MRIs after an acute symptomatic whiplash injury. They took 100 patients that were age-matched for these 100. There were 100 patients that were in a whiplash injury. They got MRIs on them, and they compared those to 100 patients that had no injury. They didn't know which was which. They were blinded, and they didn't really find any difference between the ones that weren't whiplashed and the ones that were. So they couldn't tell by looking at the MRI which ones had been whiplashed and which ones had not. And so only in the most severe grades of whiplash were the findings very useful. So they basically determined that the MRI was not very useful for evaluating a patient with a whiplash. So I'm going to let this be the segue into Dr. LaRouche, who will talk about the cervical spine.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. As Dr. McClellan mentioned, I'm a French-Canadian, so I speak quickly, and English is my second language, so tell me to slow down if I need to. I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about a continuum. I want to talk about the neck only, which we call the cervical spine, and I wanted to go from what's abnormal and how abnormal can happen simply based on genetics, some medical conditions, age, some mild trauma, or some severe trauma. So I'll try to give you the continuum from the very basic to the very advanced, and I'll cover a lot of things that Dr. McClellan did, but really try to break it down to just show you the examples and how it differs from what we consider a normal neck. So unfortunately, as we get older, the majority of things don't improve, except for one, they get a little bit more more characteristics and a little bit more wear and tear in terms of our body's anatomy. And the neck is no difference. You can get arthritis in your hip. You can get arthritis in your hands. You can also get arthritis in your neck simply from wear and tear. This is what the baseline is in terms of what we consider normal. So this is someone who's got a normal MRI. And just to give the anatomy, so this is someone's face who's probably facing this way. So you're kind of seeing them on profile. The back of the head is here. This is the actual spine itself. So these are the vertebral bodies that are the black, the boxes here, which is bone. And the discs on this sequence are black, just because it's a slightly different sequence than I showed before. This is your brain, the brain stem. And the spinal cord is floating in this fluid called cerebrospinal fluid. And there's also bone behind the spinal cord that encases it and protects it. The thing to remember when we look at some imaging is that not all tissue is created equal. If you cut your skin heals quite rapidly. Within a few weeks, your skin can mend itself and make new skin cells. If you break a bone, it might take a little bit longer. It might be 6 weeks, but the bone has the ability to mend itself and create new bone cells and repair that fracture. That's not true for spinal cord. Spinal cord tissue is the exact same as brain tissue. So certain tissues in your body, brain, spinal cord, heart, for example, what you're born with is what you get. Unfortunately, it doesn't heal very well, and the scar tissue that's formed after an injury does not have the same ability to do what it did before. And the best way to think of a spinal cord, it's a living electrical wire that has to have oxygen and food and nutrition to be able to conduct the signals that it needs from the brain down to the different parts of the body. And it regulates everything. You're able to have sensation, Your ability to move your muscles, your reflexes, some of the functions of your heart, for example, are all controlled through these nerves that get the signal back from the brain. One of the most common things we see, and you'll be wondering why I have a picture of a jelly donut, one of the most common things we see is someone says, I literally woke up this morning and my arm was numb and I had pain shooting down my hands. And they often go see their hand surgeon. They think they must have hit their hand or their funny bone or something. And a lot of that comes from the neck. And the reason I put a picture of a jelly donut is because that's exactly what your discs are. As Dr. McClellan was saying, the outside of the disc is this nice, tough kind of fibrous tissue that holds everything in. And the inside of the disc is pretty soft and squishy, just like a jelly donut. So if you get a flat tire or the jelly squeezes out of the jelly donut and it goes where it's not supposed to, it can often cause irritation on one of those electrical wires, which is known as a nerve. And that can manifest as numbness, weakness, or shooting pain. And people often describe pain from a pinched nerve as different. If you hit your finger with a hammer, you'll say it's kind of throbbing, it's achy, it's sore. If you have pain that comes from a nerve which is misfiring, we call that neurogenic pain, as in pain that comes from a nerve, and it's often like an electric shock or someone's pouring hot water or a lightning bolt. It's a very different type of pain than what people describe when they have a mechanical injury or a break. And if the disc herniates back and squeezes at the nerve, well, they might actually pinch off a specific nerve. And this is what an abnormal MRI is. So this is the same view from the side. You can see how these black discs line up fairly well. And this one's got a big pouch that goes out and has been squirted out. And then if you view the same spine from the top down, so imagine that the patient's feet are towards you and the head's towards the screen. This is left, this is right. There's a disc that's squeezed out and it's pinching one of the nerves on that side as opposed to this one, which is going nice and straight. And even the spinal cord is a little tilted because it's being pushed by that disc. Each of those nerves has a very specific function. And they kind of all merge together into what we call the brachial plexus, which is kind of like the network or the hub for the upper extremities. And then the nerves go out and have a very specific sensation or patch of skin that they provide sensation for. So we'll check for your strength, we'll check for your sensation, we'll check for your reflexes and see how those are affected. Not all pinched nerves need surgery. And in fact, what I would tell you is the majority of the patients that come to us with a pinched nerves get told, we know from good trials that with the proper amount of time, rest, maybe some activity modification, and some medications to help with your pain, that jelly will dry out as it's been squeezed out from the disc. Your MRI will actually look like it has less compression a few months from now, maybe 6 months from now, and things will improve on their own. So the majority of the time, when it's a nerve that's being pinched, we will often say, let's try conservative treatment first. The same is not true if the spinal cord itself, which is here, is being damaged. Because we know that if there's damage to the spinal cord, that is permanent. Even if I take the pressure off, it may not heal and may not go back to what it was before. So one of the common bread and butter surgeries that we do is if you have a disc herniation that's irritating either the spinal cord or one of the nerves, is we'll do what we call an ACDF, an anterior cervical discectomy infusion. So to be able to get there, we actually have to take out the rest of the disc. So we come from the front of the neck, we'll move the breathing tube called the trachea and the swallowing tube called the esophagus out of the way. We'll get to the spine, we'll get to the right disc which is being diseased and herniated. We'll take all of it out and reach really gingerly back there using either a microscope or loops to see what we're doing and take away the pressure from the spinal cord. And then after that, because the disc is now removed, we can't let that space empty. We'll put something, usually a piece of bone or maybe a metal cage, to fuse those two levels together. And essentially, you lose that disc. So that part of your spine will never move again. It's been fused solid. But at least whatever was irritated and compressing the nerve of the spinal cord has been removed. So there is a cost for us to do surgery, which is why we don't jump up and down and say that every disc herniation needs a surgery. And you can imagine, as Dr. McClellan was saying, how this entire spine is meant to move. If I've stopped this segment from moving, well, over the years, the segment just above and just below, they have to make up for the slack. So they'll see increased wear, and they're more likely to have problems in the future because all of a sudden, they now have to do twice the work that they previously had. What I showed you in the first slide was just a single disc herniation. This is what happens when you have bad arthritis of your spine. So this is not just, this is a normal spine here, lots of room for the spinal cord. You can see here that all these discs are collapsed. There's spurs on the bone, and at multiple levels, this spinal cord is being squeezed and compressed. And the funny thing with this disease process is that most things, when things are going wrong, people have pain. You burn yourself, it hurts. You break a bone, it hurts. You have a signal to say, I have pain, something must be wrong. And a lot of patients with this don't actually come in with pain. If the spinal cord is not working, some of the very subtle signals start misfiring, or maybe the signal is not getting there at the same time. So people often have difficulties with doing things like their buttons. They have difficulty shaving, writing their names, because their coordination is starting to be off. They actually walk, and they're having difficulty walking. Their feet are a little bit farther apart, and they fall lots. And they buy a cane, and they don't know why. They just, I'm tripping more these days. Must be my shoes. So it's often a disease that's missed and late diagnosed. And again, the problem with this is, once you have damage to your spinal cord, the best we can do, the best we hope for, by decompressing the spinal cord, is preventing further damage. There's no guarantee that you'll recover what you've already lost. And in fact, I remember my first referral. So we work at the county, and we see all kinds of patients at the Zuckerberg County Hospital, which is fantastic. My first referral that I had upon starting practice was from the emergency department, and they said that the police were just driving by, and they saw this guy who was clearly drunk in public in the middle of the day. So they brought him in for a talk screen. Turns out, didn't have a single drop of alcohol. He had really bad neck arthritis and couldn't walk straight because he had such bad myelopathy that he looked drunk in public in the middle of the day. So it's one of the diseases that we often see, and we often see late. And unfortunately, even with the best technology today, the goal of surgery is to prevent further progression, not necessarily restore them back to where they were before. So for that surgery, it's a more involved surgery. We sometimes go from the front, sometimes we go from the back. This is a representation of what we do. So because the spine is encased in bone, and this is viewed from the back of your neck, so you'd be facing the screen, we often use these tools like a high-speed burr. It looks like a Dremel tool if you've seen that. And we very finely cut some troughs in the bone and remove the bone and make your spine a convertible. We basically take all the bone off the back to make room for all the spinal cord and all the nerves. But because we've taken away some major ligaments and we've taken away a lot of the bone, the risk is that the stability that you had of your neck is no longer there. And if we just leave it like that, your head might start falling forward and you might have further pressure in your spinal cord. So if we decompress, we often have to fuse. And the way we fuse is by adding screws and metal rods and also bone graft to try and get the bones to heal to one another. So again, you lose that motion from the zone that was operated on. Not all surgery that we do results in this. There are surgeries that what we call motion sparing, but the vast majority of what the classic decompression and fusions are something like this. Now, we said that you can have these disease simply by having arthritis. There's also some specific, arthritis is a very generic term just to say that you've got some wear and tear at the bones or the articular surfaces of your joints. There's lots of different types of arthritis. So for example, someone who has clearly a lot of malalignment, a lot of wear and tear, can have a bad neck because of rheumatoid arthritis. Now, this used to be quite common because the drugs we used to treat rheumatoid arthritis have become so good, it's actually quite rare for us to see advanced rheumatoid arthritis of the neck these days. There's other conditions that as trauma surgeons we see quite often, and this is a rare condition called ankylosing spondylitis. And if you notice carefully, there's actually bone growing where the discs are. So this spine used to be mobile. Now this is one long solid bone that can't move at all. And the issue is if you have even a minor fall and you bump your head, before, because you had all these motion segments, you could absorb the injury and kind of recoil. When your spine is fused, it cracks like a long bone, like a piece of spaghetti. And it just snaps very easily. So these patients are much, much higher risk of having spine injuries and spinal fractures because their spine, we call this a bamboo spine. It's absolutely rigid and it can't move. There's also another condition that's similar, that they make tons of extra bone. And we call this DISH, which stands for diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis. Fancy words for extra bone where it doesn't belong. And some of these patients have so much extra bone that grows in the front of their neck that they can't actually swallow. So they present because they have swallowing difficulties and they have a hard time talking. And it's secondary to this bone that's grown over the years and has taken up so much space where the soft tissues are not compressed and displaced. So those are conditions that can happen without any injury. This is simply a little bit of wear and tear, we call arthritis, or specific conditions that can affect your spine without any actual trauma. So then we'll get into some more of the sprains and whiplashes. problem with whiplash, as Dr. McClellan was alluding to, is there's no magic blood tests. There's no magic x-ray. And there's no magic MRI I can take to tell me this person had whiplash and this one didn't. And as a result, a lot of it because of litigious practices, there's a lot of people that have an incentive to claim an injury, and a whiplash is a good one to claim. I can't tell if you had whiplash or not by examining you, and I can't tell if you had whiplash or not by doing an MRI. So as a result, we see a lot of this. And it's a challenge for us because some people are genuinely truly hurt, and some of them aren't. And it's very difficult for us as physicians to be able to make the difference and help the ones that need help and to brush off the ones that aren't and are trying to milk the system. So one of the ways that we've done that with my senior colleague back there, Dr. McClellan, is that we actually have done some of our own research. So I'll skip you the details and I'll show you the highlight. First of all, you'll probably recognize this guy right away. And one of the things he didn't tell you he does, he's also the team doctor for the National Professional Rodeo Cowboy Association, who he travels around and attends to all the cowboys. So this was my first rodeo, I could say that. It's my first rodeo. And I could tell I wasn't part of the club because I didn't have a belt buckle that was bigger than covers a half my abdomen. So what we did is we took a bunch of rodeo riders because these guys get on the horse and see forces that are significantly, well, at least we thought were significantly higher than what most people see in a car crash. The problem with a car crash is I can get an MRI after you crash the car, but I have no way of knowing what your neck looked like 10 minutes before the accident, a year before the accident, if you've had some arthritis that was there before. The thing with a rodeo rider is I can put them in an MRI 10 minutes before their ride. I can put a mouth guard in them that it records exactly how much force their neck and their head sees. We can do concussion testing before and after where they get these kind of funny goggles on and they kind of check their reflexes. And then we can put them back in the MRI immediately after the ride and say, is there a difference from before and after with no other confounding factors? So just to give you an example, when you come back upon, if you ever want to go to Mars and you're an Elon Musk fan, you can expect to see 3 Gs upon reentry. If you were a little bit more of a cowboy in the early space programs, you might have gone to 7 Gs. Jet fighters, the maximum they can sustain before you start having mechanical problems with the aircraft are 9, 12 Gs. We can, you know, a lot of death and serious injuries have been recorded as 50 Gs and 100 Gs. Brief 100 G exposures have been recorded with people surviving them, but it's a very significant force. So what I'd like to show you here is a video. And if you look at the bottom, so this guy's wearing a mouth guard. You'll see in 2 seconds, you'll see the mouth guard he's wearing. And the bottom of the video will be the G-forces that he's exposed to during his ride. So I'll let that play once. So there's the mouth guard. And off he goes. And his head is hit in the back of the horse repeatedly. And he's recording a lot of G's. So I'm going to rewind that for a second because I want to show you one thing. If you look carefully, right... Watch him very carefully. He's going to lose consciousness for about 2 seconds. So once his head hits the big peak right there, his arm drops. He goes floppy. He doesn't move for a second or two. Oh, and he kind of comes back and everybody comes in and gets him off the horse. So this is the first study that we know. We haven't published this yet, by the way. Dr. McClellan's been invited to go present in Italy at the World Spine Congress soon. So he's off to a nice little trip when I'm doing all the call at home. So this guy had a peak of 62 Gs. So when his head hit the horse and he lost consciousness, we recorded in his mouth guard 62 Gs of force directly at his head. The best part is his MRI after the ride, stone cold normal. No difference whatsoever than the MRI before the ride. So it's really hard for us to be able to use these types of things. Even though we have great tests, it doesn't tell us who's injured and who's not and what the definition of an injury is. It's very vague and it's very challenging for us to be able to pinpoint these things. If you go from a sprain or whiplash, some of the more common things that we see is neck fractures. And they go from the low energy fractures to the high energy ones. So I'll just show you 2 examples. First of all, as Dr. McClellan was saying, some of the anatomy is unique in the top of the neck. So the atlas, which is named after the Greek mythology, Atlas, holding the world, so holding your head upon the rest of your spine. And the axis is where the center of rotation happens. So a very common fracture we see in people, especially in the older patient populations, people in their 80s and 70s, is they fall, they'll hit their head, and they actually break their dens, which is part of the axis. The treatment is varied. Even if we say we're going to do non-operative treatment, It doesn't mean we give you a tap on the back and out the door you go. It involves treatment. So non-operative can involve, this is called a halo vest immobilization. So these are actually pins that kind of get tightened to your bone, to your skull. And they go in a crown, and the crown is attached to a vest, which holds it rigidly and prevents motion. And it gives, it's basically a cast for your spine, and it allows the bones to heal with very minimal motion. Or we can give you a collar, which does half the job, but is also much less of a pain in the butt to wear. But sometimes we say that you might need surgery. So here's an example. We'll test your radiological skills. So this is an x-ray, and it's kind of a lateral x-ray. So we shoot the patient's face in this way, and we're shooting across their neck. And if you're observant, you'll notice that part of the bone's up here, and part of the bone's down there, and the two of them don't line up. We'll get a CT scan to better see exactly what's going on, and we'll notice there's a fracture right here, and part of that bone is displaced. And then one of the interesting things you might ask yourself, you might want to do a little bit of investigative work and say, why did this fracture take place? Well, the top two here used to be an articulation. They used to be able to move. And in this particular patient, they're fused. So she has no motion between the bones up here. And as a result, when she falls and hits her head, that force, instead of being dissipated across these joints, goes right through the bone and fractures. If you also remember, this is where the spinal cord lives. And that piece of bone is starting to push into the spinal cord and cause some damage. So if she's got a collar and she sneezes or she has another fall, it could be catastrophic. And she's actually perfectly neurologically intact at this point. So in this case example, this is something we'll offer surgery. So we'll often try to get control of the head by putting a clamp on the head. You're asleep at this point. You don't feel a thing. And then there's a before and after. So this is the fracture that's displaced. You could see it's a displace. And now we line it up. And then we have fancy tools like navigation, which allow us to do a CT scan intraoperatively and actually visualize where drills and screws are going so we can have very, very precise accuracy. Because if you remember, this is where the spinal cord is. This is the trachea. There's a big blood vessel called the vertebral artery right here that supplies a lot of important blood flow to the brain. And if you put a drill through that, it makes it for a bad day for the surgeon and the patient simultaneously. And then this is what it looks like afterwards. So this is the same patient where we line up the fracture. It's not perfect, but it's much better. We've added what we call bone graft to try and get this to fuse in the back. And you can see the screws and rods that are just stopping just short of where the artery is and are just the right length to cover the other side. And technology has come a long way to help us achieve these results by being better able to visualize intraoperatively our instrumentation and our reductions. The second case is a gentleman who's extremely lucky, young, fit, active guy, fell off a ladder, and I'll play the CT once and I'll show you in slow motion what it looks like after. But this is a CT scan looking from left to right, and he's actually dislocated his neck. You can see it right here. And on the other side, and then I'll show you the x-ray. So you can see that these, what we call these facets, line up like shingles. And there's a shingle, and there's a shingle. And these two shingles are actually almost, it used to be on this side, it almost jumped and it got stuck nose on nose. And we call that a perch facet. And the other ones line up like shingles. And then we also do an MRI to see what his cord looks like. And this gentleman, he's still able to wiggle his toes and move his feet. But you can tell, I'll show you what it looks like here. His cord, this is the disc which is torn. All the soft tissues in the back of his neck are all torn, and he's got lots of blood where it used to be. And his spinal cord is precariously being squeezed between some of the bone, some of the disc. And he's already got a little bit of blood in his spinal cord right here. You can tell there's a white spot, so he's got a hemorrhage in the spinal cord. So this is, for us, the ultimate surgical emergency, because if those little bones that are perched keep moving and fall on the other side, he could result in complete loss of his lower extremities and part of his hands. So we take him to the operating room, and place traction, and we pull. So this is a dislocated spine, and after we pull enough, we can get the fracture to reduce. But we know that all the ligaments, all the disc, and everything else that holds the spine in that position has been torn. So he immediately goes on to have surgery. And because of the nature of this injury, because he's torn both the disc as well as all the ligaments in the back, we'll actually do both the front and the back. So it's actually two surgeries where you start off the first hour or two in one position. We put him at a table that flips, go to the back, and then the same surgery, open up the back and reinforce. So this is that ACDF I was talking to you about. So there's a cage here that we've taken all the disc out. We've put some bone graft. We want to get this to heal from end to end. And then we've added a plate to stabilize it. And then we'll flip them over and go from the back and add the screws and rods to be able to stabilize. So in ortho, we took away a lot of the bone. We made him a convertible, so we took away the bone back here because we know that the spinal cord, if it's been lightly damaged, will continue to swell over the next few days and few hours. And we'll make sure that as it does, it has room to expand without having any further compression. And then this is what a CT scan looks like. So that covers kind of my continuum of injury from the neck. I'm going to turn it over to my other senior partner, Dr. Pekmeji, who will walk you through the low back. Thank you.
I'm just going to follow up with our journey with the low back injuries. I am just going to go over the basic spinal unit, the anatomy. Dr. McClellan and Dr. LaRouche covered this really well, in essence. So a functional spine unit is composed of two vertebral bodies and a disc, and we have the erector spinal muscles in the back, which sort of acts as a tension band. Disc structure, again, is quite important here. We have the annulus fibrosus that is the periphery of the disc, and we have the nucleus pulposus, which has special proteins that attracts the water. And the important thing about the disc is it is very strong under pressure. It tolerates axial load very well, but it is weak in shear. A little bit of basic biomechanics about the spinal column. If you think about a crane, the front of the spine is under compression, and the back of the muscles provide the tension. And this is very important when it comes to the spinal injuries, and we'll go review this over and over again. Again, when we look at the spinal column from the side, anything in front of the spinal canal, we call it the front, the anterior structures, and anything behind is the posterior. And the anterior column is always under compression, and the posterior column is under tension. The reason is the load, the gravity line, pretty much always travels in the front of the spine. That's why the anterior column is under compression, and everything behind acts as a tension band. And that's where your erector spinal muscles comes into play. That's why we stress the strengthening these muscles in back injuries. They provide the tension band and help to distribute the load equally among all the structures. One more point about the loads. Again, the erector spinal muscles are your tension band. We have the disc that resists the compressive loads. But depending on the orientation of the discs, there is some shear load as well. The spine may try to slip forward. And that's where the facet joints comes into play that Dr. McClellan mentioned. There are little joints in the back behind the spinal canal that resist this shear force. So the disc, again, when it is healthy, it can attract a lot of water. So the analogy with the tire is, I think, the pretty good one. An inflated tire, the sides of the disc, the annulus fibrosus, will be tense and straight. And like a sort of partially inflated or deflated tire, as the disc loses its ability to attract water, the tension goes down, and the edges of the annulus will start to bulge to each sides, literally like a flat tire. And this happens over time due to a variety of reasons. The circulation of the disc might be compromised, resulting in decreased ability to attract water. And it can present in a variety of ways. Starting from a normal disc, in the early stages, it may just collapse a little bit. As the disc loses its ability to resist the axial loads, then it is more susceptible to the damage of the shear forces. Because when it is totally inflated, it resists the shear much better. But as it loses its ability to carry the load, then these shear forces become more predominant, and slowly wear and tear starts to happen in the annulus. And as there are little tears in the annulus, the more fluid, nucleus, starts to find its way across those little tears and may result in a bulging disc, then it could be a herniated disc. And as the arthritis process continues, we may see a variety of presentations. When we look at the disc herniations or prolapses, as I said, there are many, many presentations. One is if it just goes a little bit off through the annulus, it might be a simple disc bulge. When there's a total tear in the annulus, the disc material goes out of the this the annulus and then starts to press on the nerve roots, as you can see here, causing the radiculopathy that we were talking about. And sometimes if it can completely dissociate from the disc itself and starts may travel up or down in the spinal canal, which we call a sequester disc. This is an MRI find, MRI and of the lumbar spine. And I think the important point here is, unfortunately, these changes rarely happens isolated. This is here, as you can see, the L4-5 disc is degenerated and there's a herniation. But look at the 5-1. This is a healthy disc with a bright signal on the T2. This is started to degenerate. And L3-4 is on the way too. And this is an important point from the axial back pain because it is never a one disc. As this is a chain reaction, and as one part starts to degenerate, the adjacent segment's motion may change as well. And it is frequently associated, goes along together. So it's never one disc. So this is just a few, this is out of the press, the management of acute low back pain, which is very common in the normal population. This is just published last month. And the majority of the acute low back pain resolves on its own, regardless of the treatment. And that's why the American College of Physicians are now recommending using non-pharmacological treatment initially, like superficial heat, massage, acupuncture kind of treatments. And if the patients need any sort of pharmacological treatment, they recommend either non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or Aleve, or skeletal muscle relaxants. There's no role for opioids. And in chronic pain, chronic low back pain patients, again, the first line is still exercise, multidisciplinary rehabilitation, acupuncture, mindfulness, and even the other ones. And when it comes to pharmacological treatment, again, still non-steroid anti-inflammatory medications has been shown to prove benefit, followed by antidepressants. There's still no real role for opioids, just as a note. So, in a patient with acute low back pain, when do we worry? When do we get imaging? This is a list of the diseases that can cause the low back pain. There can be muscle contusions, ligamentous strain, a herniated disc, etc. And there are the bad things that can still cause the back pain, such as metastatic diseases or infections or abscesses. And even non-spine-related diseases may cause present as back pain. So when a patient comes to our office, the way we approach to it is we want to eliminate the possibility of bad things happening. And how do we identify those? We have some red flags. If the patients are younger than 20 or older than 50, we want to get an imaging. If they describe recent weight loss or persistent fevers or night sweats, then we start to think about, well, could there be an infection or a tumor? If they have a history of immune compromise or prolonged steroid use, it is the same thing. Can they have an infection? And neurologic deficit is the most important red flag. You can have low back pain, no problem, but if you have weakness in your leg, that's a problem. Because as Dr. LaRouche was mentioning, once there's damage to the nerves, the chances of recovery is low. And the longer that damage continues, the less likely the recovery is. So we want to intervene fast. So what are the red flags for malignancy? Again, history of, obviously, cancer, unexplained weight loss, increasing pain at night, and age over 50. In those cases, we would like to get some imaging. For infection, similar, any disease that may cause immune compromise, but even urinary tract infections, having back pain in that setting, might be associated with spinal infection. This patient was a 54-year-old gentleman who had multiple compression fractures in his upper back, initially treated non-operatively. Unfortunately, 3 months later, his pain persisted, and when we did an MRI, he actually developed an infection in the same setting. And then he required an extensive surgery to treat it. Another red flag is the cauda equina syndrome. As if you remember, Dr. McClellan was mentioning, cauda equina is the very end of the spinal cord. After the level of L1, when the spinal cord ends, all the nerve roots that go to our lower extremities and bowel and bladder control travel as individual nerve roots. And if there is a pathology that compresses all of these nerve roots at the same time, then we may lose our bowel and bladder function. And that is a very important finding. If we have patients who are complaining of perineal numbness, a new onset of urinary problems, or bowel or bladder or fecal incontinence, for example, that is very important information for us because this is a surgical emergency. We cannot wait. The time to intervene with this problem is of essence. So the recommendation is if when a patient has such a finding, they have to go to the emergency room right away. And this applies to low back pain too. The patients may have some shooting pain down to their legs. As long as there's no weakness or these bowel or bladder findings, you can wait. You can get your pain medication. It's going to be fine. But the moment there are real neurologic findings in the form of either weakness or numbness, then it is better to reach for help. And the other final red flag, we don't want to miss a fracture, right? We don't want to miss a tumor. We don't want to miss an infection. We don't want to miss a neurologic deficit. And finally, we don't want to miss a fracture. The red flags for this is steroid use, osteoporosis, female gender, age more than 50, and history of major trauma. You can see a very minor fracture there. Again, Dr. McClellan mentioned thoracolumbar junction is the most common area where we see the fractures, as it is a mechanical transition zone. What are the injury patterns? So during any trauma, as Dr. Lersch was showing in that beautiful video, actually, there are a lot of forces that apply on the spine. We have flexion, we have extension, we have rotation, and again, we have compression and distraction, which is sometimes the forces may apply to pull the spine apart in the axial direction. And again, the key part is the front is under compression, the back is under tension. This is a little detailed, but this is the most classic classification of the injuries. That's why I'm going to just go over through it. Again, we have the front, which we call the anterior column. And if we divide it into two, we have the anterior and the middle column and the posterior column. And then he classified major injuries into compression fractures, burst fractures, flexion distraction injuries, and fracture dislocations. So compression fracture happens with simple flexion load. When we flex, we increase the load in the front of the vertebral bodies, and only the anterior, the most anterior part of the bodies may break. It can be in a lot of very variable patterns. And osteoporotic compression fractures for that is the most common reason for it. What happens is with the change in the hormonal status or aging, as we lose the bone volume, the strength of the vertebral body goes down. So remember, the front was under compression. So as the body gets weaker and weaker, even with minor trauma, it may fracture. Burst fractures happens with direct axial load. It can have some flexion component too, but it's mainly axial load. And the vertebral body spreads in multiple directions. Flexion distraction injury, this is when the seat belts didn't have the shoulder strap. Essentially, when you decelerate suddenly, all of the forces on the spine try to separate the spine in the axial direction. And the top may separate from the bottom, essentially. And fracture dislocation is the most severe injury. It can happen through a variety of mechanisms, but essentially, as Dr. Lersch was showing you, everything is disrupted. Anterior, posterior, all the columns are disrupted, and it's a high risk for spinal cord injury. So how do we treat these injuries? Compression fractures, our goal is early mobilization, manage the pain. We can give patients braces to control the pain as well as the deformity. Another way to treat these is inject some bone cement into it. This was started in the 1980s to treat tumors composed of blood vessels and now extended into the compression fractures. A more fancy way of doing that is inserting a balloon into the broken bone, inflate it to restore the height, and then fill the gap with a cement. Sometimes, very rarely, we may need to operate on these fractures. And essentially, We only operate on the patients when all three columns are failed. Remember I mentioned compression fracture only involves the front. When the posterior tension band fails, then we need to operate. As this is an example of that. So you can see the front. You can see the crunching of the vertebral body. But in this case, this was a young patient. The posterior elements were also torn. You can see the tear there. And in this case, we fixed it from the back, like restored the tension band with rods and screws. Usually the compression fractures can be managed conservatively without surgical intervention, but sometimes they may progress much faster. So this is an 80-year-old female who had a simple syncopal fall, looks like a benign fracture. But unfortunately, over a course of 6 weeks, it went from a simple compression fracture to gradual collapse to almost total collapse. And she developed neurologic symptoms as well. She started a weakness in her legs. And here you can see the fracture fragment. Even though this was relatively intact, it was pushed back, pressing on the spinal cord. And we had to fix her with injecting cement and putting screws and rods to stabilize her back. Burst fracture is the axial load one. You can see as we are looking at the patient from the bottom again. This is the front, this is the back. This time, the middle part is broken and is put, the bony pieces are pushed into the spinal canal. This is another illustration of it. As the bony pieces are pushed into the canal, they may press on the neurologic structures causing neurologic deficit. And again, the majority of the burst fractures can be treated non-operatively with braces. And the only time that we go for surgery is, again, when the posterior tension band is disrupted. Flexion distraction injuries, the seat belt injuries, where all the columns, all three columns, are under distractive forces. It can happen through the bone or through the ligaments and disc. And these are usually surgical treatments. This is an example of it. You can see the pattern. There's a fracture line that goes all along. You can follow it here. It involves all three columns. And we fix it with screws and rods to hold the spine together. And you can see before, you can see the fracture line here. And after the surgery, we were able to reduce everything back to the original alignment. And fracture dislocation, this is the most severe injury. All three columns are completely disrupted and the spine is shifted. This is an example of that injury. So here, you can see the disc is disrupted. The facet joints are, the shingles that Dr. Lerush was mentioning are disrupted. And again, the spinal cord is in jeopardy. This was a 35-year-old female, and she was, again, very lucky. She was neurologically intact. And this is what we saw in the surgery. So this is all the posterior ligaments torn after we cut the skin. This is what we encountered. And this is the facet joints, which we don't normally see. This is the cartilage of the facet joints. We are looking at this part. Normally, this is covered, which is the analogous to this part, by the other facet joint, the shingles. But now it is bare. So we restored the normal alignment by reducing the spine, as you can see here. In the original x-ray, this was further up front and then fixed it. A few words about the minimally invasive spine surgery. Since 1820s, when the first lumbar discectomy or laminectomy was performed, we came a long way. In 1980s, we started to put percutaneous screws. And since 2000s, this has sort of become more and more common. And what minimally invasive spine surgery means is we do the same procedures, the same goals, the same accomplishments, but through simple, smaller incisions. The advantage is less blood loss, less soft tissue dissection, faster recovery. And we usually do this through special instruments and tubes. For example, the usual discectomy, we make an incision, we dissect all the muscles of the posterior elements of the spine, and then get down and take the disc out. In minimally invasive surgery, we essentially make a small incision, we put multiple dilators, and do the same thing. TLIF stands for transforaminal lumbar interbody fusion. Essentially, we go from the back of the spine, take out the disc, and put a cage. Normal TLIF, we dissect all the muscles down to the bone, on both sides, a lot of blood loss, a lot of dissection. When we do minimal invasive TLIF, all we do is small Perkin stab incisions. Here's an example of an application of minimally invasive spine surgery. So this patient had a three-column injury. You can see the fracture here in the front, fracture in the back. You can see the disrupted ligaments. Luckily, the spinal cord was intact. So these are the x-rays. This is the fractured level. So what we do is we make small, we mark our levels. We have special needles that are hollow. And these little circles represents the pedicles where we put the screws into the vertebral bodies. So we essentially put the guide wires, the needles, and then advance them under X-ray guidance. And once all four of them are down, then we put guide wires through them, all through small incisions. And once the guide wires are in, we have special dilators. We tap the pathway, and then we put the screws in. Again, through small incisions. Here, all four screws are in. We are looking from the top. These are the small stab incisions in the skin. And we have our rod, and we insert the rod through that small hole. And this is the end result. In the old days, we used to do this open, dissect all the muscles. Now we can do it through small incisions. Another example, a 52-year-old lady who had an unstable fracture. And again, we put multiple guide wires, then insert our screws, and pass the rods through stab incisions. And this is the final result. We can do even anterior surgeries now through a 2-inch incision. We can essentially take out the broken vertebral body, replace it with a titanium, special titanium cage, and do the same tension band construct in the back, again, all through small incisions. We can do the same surgery for tumor patients or scoliosis patients. And that concludes my part.
Great question. So it can be used for a couple of different reasons. The classic reason is that cortisone is a very strong anti-inflammatory. So if you think that you've got a nerve root that's being pinched and it's being irritated and some of the inflammation constricts and makes further pinching, if you could put cortisone next to it, you might be able to relieve some of the pressure, a little bit of the irritation, and then that way it'll get better and your numbness or your shooting pain on your arm might improve. The second reason we use it is because, as my two senior colleagues have demonstrated, simply having an MRI with wear and tear doesn't tell me that's where the problem's coming from. Because if I MRI everybody in this room, most people will have abnormalities in their spine. So we often use cortisone and another medication that's shorter acting to try and tell us if our hunch as to which part of the spine is the problem is the correct one. So we'll do a very simple procedure where we'll put some freezing and some cortisone against that one nerve root. And if all their pain or 80% of their pain goes away, then it's a sign for us of saying, okay, I think I know which surgery to do and exactly where to focus for that surgery. Versus if I do the injections, you say, I'm no better. Well, I'm not going to put you through the risk of a big surgery because my likely outcome has been kind of persuaded or determined by how you react to that cortisone shot. So the question, I'll just repeat it for everybody, is why is the pressure on your disc go up when you're reclining?
Come talk to the mic.
Yeah.
That was the study that I quoted was one patient where they put a pressure transducer inside the disc and actually measured his pressures over a 24-hour period doing various activities of daily living. And they noticed that the pressure in his disc was elevated after he'd been in bed for 6 or 7 hours. And the theory was that the disc becomes rehydrated and sort of, you know, fills back up. And I'm not sure that's reliable because that's only one patient. You know, any experiment that you do, if you only have one N equals one, you know, I'm not sure that means a lot. But there have been prior studies by other researchers looking at disc pressures, and it was always thought that your pressure in your disc was much higher sitting versus standing. But everybody knows if you're leaning forward like this, disc pressures go way up. But this study in this one patient basically corroborated all the prior research except for the sitting versus standing and that instance in lying down after 7 hours. So I don't know the reason. They suspected that it was rehydration of the disc.
But the classic teaching is, again, when you are reclining or lying down flat, that is sort of the lower end of the spectrum. And the worst thing that you can do for practical purposes is when you are carrying a load, you want to hold it close to your body. And when you are leaning forward and trying to lift something, that is the maximum sort of disc pressure. So that's the practical information.
Yeah, it's actually a good observation. So evolution is a funny thing. And when you look at embryos and fetuses, they don't have an S-curve, their spine, their C-curve. But the problem is, for a C-curve works really well if you walk on all fours, but for us to be able upright and have level gaze, you have to have compensation to be able to adapt, to be able to have your eyes level to the horizon and your center of gravity over your pelvis. And the way to do that is by having these primary and secondary curves that allows your center of gravity to be perfectly centered over your feet and be able to walk on 2 feet. So it is a good question. And evolution is funny because we probably started off walking on all fours. So our spines probably were never perfectly designed for that purpose. We just adapted. So the questions, I'll repeat it, is when doing yoga, what do the spine surgeons say about doing headstands?
So how is the headstand, essentially?
Dr. Peck-Mazza will now demonstrate a headstand. I think with most things that would... Sorry, you want to answer that one?
Yes,
I think most things I tell you is in the absence of a condition which somebody tells you, don't do this because I've just put a fusion, I'm trying to get this bone to heal, or you have bad stenosis, pain's a good guide. Do what you're able to do, and as long as it's not causing you harm and you're not feeling pain and you can still walk the next day. And that rule applies for 99.9% of medicine, what we do in terms of patients. There's a few exceptions, but, you know, I think headstands falls into the within, and if you can do it, great.
I think it comes down to flexibility too, like being active. Like all the recommendations over there was essentially keeping yourself active. And one thing that we sort of encourage the patients to do in the setting of acute or chronic low back pain, and an essential part of the treatment is this fight the fear avoidance beliefs. We want you to be active, even if it hurts. The more active you are, it's going to get better eventually. And an observation that I have is when the patients walk into the clinic, it is not uncommon to see a horrible X-ray or an MRI, and the patients are the ones that are usually saying, oh, you know, I've been doing great for 70 years, and just like I was skiing and I started to have this pain. And when you look at their MRI, they have slips, scoliosis all over the place. But one thing that I observed is, you know, if they are active, if their weight is well controlled, and they somehow keep their flexibility, whether it's yoga, tai chi, you name it, they are the less disabled patients. That's just an observation that I have.
Buyer beware. So the two questions are, what's the recovery period for surgery? The second is, should I go out and buy a very expensive mattress? Recovery for surgery is very varied. And Dr. Peck-Mazza gave good examples in terms of minimally invasive surgery. We often have day surgery now. You come in the morning, you get your surgery, and you go home the same day. That's very different than what it was 15, 20 years ago. Some surgeries that Dr. Peck-Mazza showed you where he does these very, very large corrections for tumor and goes through the chest and deflates the lung and then goes in the back and does that. Those are very long recoveries. Before you're active and you're doing sports, it's 6 months to a year. So it's a really wide variety. Dr. McClellan, do you want to talk about the mattress question?
I don't have any particular, you know, recommendations as far as a mattress, whatever is comfortable. But I will give you some recommendations on good spine health, okay? You know, diet, vitamin D, calcium, plenty of exercise, sunshine, maintain good weight control, stay off of ladders, don't do risky things. I can't tell you how many people I've seen in the last, I'm 63, I've seen a gazillion people that are over my age, up on a ladder, cleaning gutters. I can't tell you how many people have fallen off their roof or off of a ladder. Stay off of a ladder, even a ladder that's 3 feet high. There's no reason for any of you guys, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to get on a ladder. I don't care how stable it is.
How about horses?
Horses, different story. I'm straddling my horse, so I'm not straddling the ladder.
They will go hand in hand because, like, the body's response to pain is muscle spasm. And the physician may help you when they examine you. What we check is the midline pain, which sort of guides us for the bony. If you have a fracture, you'll have the midline pain. And we also look at the paravertebral, the erector spinae muscles that I was showing you, if there's any spasm in them. But again, when it is just disc pathology without any structural, you know, injuries, it might be just the spasm. But it is really hard to know it on your own, I'm going to say.
And here's the trickiest part to explain to patients. They come into a spine surgeon, then your spine clinic. They want you to do a spine operation. And I tell them, my operation will do nothing for your back pain. My operation may make your back pain worse, may make no difference. There's a small chance it makes it better. But the reason for the operation is not because your back is in pain. It's because the nerves are squeezed, because your alignment's off, because I think you might damage your spinal cord, because you don't have any more room, and now your nerves freeze when you walk more than half a block. So the majority of the operations we do have almost nothing to do with back pain. And in fact, I would tell you that if your only problem is back pain, you don't need a spine surgeon. And that's really hard to explain to patients that have been waiting for hours and months and years to see you.
Unless you have a tumor, infection, or...
Yeah, or a deformity. So the question is, if there's screening programs in the schools for scoliosis, the answer is yes. The second question is, what do you do if your kid has scoliosis? Well, you take them to... So number one, the screening programs doesn't necessarily are 100% sensitive. So whenever there's a suspicion for scoliosis, those kids are referred to a pediatric spine surgeon, and they get their x-rays taken. And depending on the magnitude of the deformity, their age, there are a variety of, you know, options, ranging from brace to surgical treatment or just simple observation. It's patient-specific, if you will. Let's put it, the question is, like, is there an age limit which an intervention make their life better as an adult? So let me explain it this way. The older they are when they are first diagnosed, the better they are off. Because as the child grows, the chances of a deformity to get worse over time is much higher. So let's say if patient is diagnosed with scoliosis at the age of 11, that patient, let's say it's a 30 degree deformity, that patient has a much higher risk of progression, eventually requiring surgery before reaching adulthood, when compared to somebody who has diagnosed with the same thing when they are 16. So eventual treatment, when the curves become worse and worse, is surgical treatment to correct the deformity. If we catch them early, then we try to modulate with braces or some more advanced techniques to sort of control the deformity to prevent it from getting to the point where it will really compromise the daily life.
So we're just going to repeat the question. The question is, why can't we replace a disc? And as Dr. McClellan says, there are. Again, it's the same as the mattresses, so I'll say buyer beware. I think there are great evidence now for cervical disc replacements that do very, very well. And now we have more mounting evidence that for specific indications and cases that those cervical disc replacements are probably a good idea and probably give you just as good as an outcome as a fusion, maybe a little bit better. A low back disc replacement, a lumbar disc replacement, has a lot more weight and a lot more forces going through those. And we've experimented with those. We've tried a few. And the ones that have been in haven't done as well. They've failed. They've had catastrophic failures. They've required revision. They've been spit out. They've had infections. So we're not at a stage where our technology or our understanding of the biomechanics and the biology that goes through and the forces are probably good enough that if I needed something done at this point and it was my low back, I'd still opt for a fusion, not a disc replacement. If it was my neck, I'd have a good conversation with my surgeon to see if I specifically met the right criteria to have a disc replacement and have a good outcome with that. So here's a good example. This is a great story. I'm going to tell it because Dr. McClellan will tell it himself. So he's got the world record for design, manufacturing, and implantation of a spine implant. So back in the day, I won't tell you how old he was or back in the day, they were doing a surgery where someone called him in and said, we need your help right away. And he walks in and literally they're trying to do a spine fusion that long with a piece of equipment that long. So he takes two of them, gets a police escort to a welder, has the welder put the two of them together with a perfect weld, goes back to the hospital, has it flash sterilized, implanted, and ta-da, the patient wakes up with successful surgery. Implant design today takes years, takes lots and lots of trials. What we're trying to do now is we've moved the yardstick so far that it's hard to make those small incremental changes to replicate what the body does so well with artificial technology. So you're absolutely right. It's changing. It's improving. Some of the changes may not all be biomechanics. Some of the changes may be biological. People are trying to find ways to regrow cartilage, rehydrate discs, and give different disc therapy. So if they do that, we might be out of a job.
So the question was, what is the difference between an orthopedic spine surgeon and a neurospine surgeon? There's really no difference. Spine surgery, spine surgery. But if you want to distinguish, if there are any differences, I would say in general, orthopedic surgeons do more deformity scoliosis work, whereas the neurosurgeons do more stuff like intradural tumors, where they have to open the spinal cord and remove a tumor. We don't do that. They do that. But there's a lot of crossover, and really the question you should ask is, if you're going to see a spine surgeon, what is his experience with the particular disease or injury that you have? I don't do deformity anymore. I did it a long time ago, but I don't do scoliosis. So you don't want me doing a scoliosis. Dr. Pacmetsi does a lot of scoliosis, so he would be the one. And some of the neurosurgeons here do just neck or just lower back. And so you really want to dial in what is their expertise and what do they do best. I just think ladders are, I've treated hundreds of ladder falls within the last couple of weeks that I've seen. So I just think getting on a ladder, particularly at our age, I'm in the age category that some of you guys, I just think it's too risky. It's just too risky. Pay for somebody to do it.
So we're going to finish off the official portion here. Thank you very much for your time and attention. We're going to be up here for as long as you guys have questions. Please feel free to come and chat with us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.